Our last case for today is United States against Ernest Clark. We'll hear first from Mr. Rosen.
Thank you, Your Honors. Excuse me. Please, the court, Mr. Rosen, appears on behalf of the defendant appellant, Ernest Clark. I think I did raise three issues in my pleadings, my briefs. I think two of them have to do with the IAD. I think it's pretty clear that this the indictment in this case came out far more than the 30 days required under the IAD, as interpreted by this court back in U.S. versus King, 393 F. Second 794, which said that it has to be within 30 days of the date of the filing of the criminal complaint, which occurred on October 12, 2010.
But that's the time when he's under arrest for the eluding charge in the state system, right? He's not under a federal arrest at that point.
Well, except for the fact that he had been arrested on October 8, 2010, and that was partially a federal arrest. The government conceded that at trial on February 23rd. To docket number 200, page 245, Mr. Lipscomb, who was the government's attorney, said, we know that, and the government's position has always been that this has been both a case of the arrest for the state, case of fleeing, as well as the armed bank robbery. There was never any charges issued for the armed bank robbery. There's never been, state cases don't issue charges for armed bank robbery. The federal government issued, slapped him with a complaint and detainer as quickly as you can blink, 4 days later. And under King anyway, it still is the clock of the federal federal complaint was issued on October 12th of 2010, and that's still the 30-day clock. And the government.
I didn't think that we had actually weighed in on this. Our sister circuits have been looking at this combination of a complaint and a detainer and have said that the clock doesn't start running until the person is actually in federal custody.
Well, my recollection from reading King, which cited Candelaria and Jones, was that the clock basically started with the 60 days, with the 30 days once the federal complaint. I think the
clock. Why?
Because that was their interpretation, from my recollection.
No, what's the sense of it? Why that rather than from the date of federal custody?
I think to get the matters moving, but that's the interpretation of the IAD, Section 9, was basically the interpretation, which by its very terms, the statute's mandatory dismissal sanction is available only in the case of an individual against whom a complaint is filed charging an individual with an offense, citing the federal statute. It's maybe to get it moving. It's maybe the interpretation of the federal statute.
Isn't it rather awkward to try to get it moving when he's in the custody of the state?
I don't think so. They can have dual prosecutions at any given time. They can file the federal indictment, get it going. I don't think that's a limitation at all. I think they can do both things at once. It's Milwaukee County.
What if they want to talk to him?
Pardon me?
What if they want to talk to him?
They can find a way to do that, I suppose. That's the government's issue. I mean, I'm just interpreting the federal.
Yeah, well, that's our issue too, right?
I understand that. It's just a question of
now. Is your idea that he should go free, or would this be? Or are you looking for a dismissal without prejudice?
Well, right? I think, and Mr. Koenig and I are both on the same wavelength on this. I think in Janik and both the IAD itself requires that it be a dismissal, and I think it has to go for a remand back to the district court to have a hearing as to whether or not it's with or without prejudice. I think that's how it's handled under the law. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have the jurisdiction. I wish you had the jurisdiction to say with prejudice. I don't think legally you do.
I don't think we'd say with prejudice for such a technical error. Well, how is he harmed by any of this?
Well, I think that's a good point. The only problem issue with that is that the IAD does not indicate that there is a harmless error option. I think I discussed this when I discussed the cult in my reply brief about the Cooney versus Falcomer issue here, where the government argued, well, harmless error. But the fact of the matter is the IAD says if you violate it, it's dismissal. There is no.
But most criminal laws, they don't actually mention harmless error.
Except for the fact that sometimes there's no caveat under those portions to talk about whether or not harmless error is or is not an option. It's just an interpretation by the courts.
But it is harmless.
But the IAD clearly states you got to dismiss.
I mean, it seems so hyper-technical. What harm did he incur?
It's a violation of... I mean, we can make the argument as to why you have a 30-day clock on the IAD in the first place. What's the harm in him?
The 30-day clock is fine, but the in this particular case, he's under custody from the state. The question is it in connection with the federal charges? And the blending of the custody and the charges is what we're doing. But what you're saying is we should go through this very elaborate procedural game of sending it back to the district court for dismissal. If the dismissal is without prejudice, then there's going to be another indictment 2 minutes later, and then he'll be right back where he is now.
That's not my call. That's the call of the courts, and that's the call of what happens.
But you know that. You agree that could happen.
That's exactly what we're looking for.
Right.
And that's basically what I think any time you have a reversal on a jury trial case, you guys go back, and we have that whole issue about whether or not he's going to go to trial again. The fact of the matter
is... There's a similar issue in another point that you've raised, which is the charge that formed the basis of the detainer, I guess, was just the one bank robbery, and then the government added on all those other bank robberies as well.
Right, and that's the Cooney versus Fulcomer issue,
right,
too.
Right.
And I think that's also where Mr. Koenig says harmless error, and I argued
and so
again.
So my question for that was suppose he's turned over to the federal authorities under the interstate agreement on detainers on only the one charge, and then a few weeks go by, and the government issues a superseding indictment in which they add the other five bank robberies. Do you see any problem with that?
Well, I think the Interstate Agreement of Detainers Act, as in Cooney versus Fulcomer, says it's got to be on the one armed bank robbery that formed the issue of the detainer.
It will be. It just will also be on the others. I mean, no one's deleting the one that he was extradited on.
No, and I understand that. I just think the case law says it's got to be on the one. And the government had every option if they wanted to do a federal detainer right off the bat, charging everything they wanted to charge. I mean, this isn't Mr. Clark didn't ask for the federal detainer. It wasn't his idea. They issued it, and they said, this is what we're doing right now.
Well,
they
was done with a writ of habeas corpus anyway. What choice did the state court have?
Pardon me? I'm sorry.
I thought that Clark was brought over to the federal court under a writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum anyway. So could the state court say, no, we've decided not to turn you over?
I don't know. I don't know if they could have or couldn't have. That's a good question. I'm not research that. I'll save my time for rebuttal.
Sure, that's fine. Mr. Koenig.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Jonathan Koenig, and I appear on behalf of the United States. If I may, I'd like to sort of disentangle what I perceive as two distinct issues. One is whether there was pre-indictment delay under the Speedy Trial Act. The other is the Interstate Agreement on Detainers issue. There could not have been any pre-indictment delay by definition in this case because Mr. Clark was not federally arrested until he wasn't physically brought into custody by the federal government until after he was indicted.
Now that's kind of a picky point, though, right? Because he's arrested by the state authorities on the 8th of October, and by the 12th of October, there is federal charges by complaint have already been issued, right?
That's correct.
So we're placing a lot of weight on the fact that it's a complaint, not an indictment, and also that the state is taking a very narrow approach to this arrest.
Well, Your Honor, I think this court's decision in Jenick really controls on this issue. A state arrest on state charges does not trigger that 30-day clock. Under the Speedy Trial Act, and this was a legitimate arrest for fleeing or eluding or whatever you call it. He was wanted for armed bank robbery, which is a state crime as well as a federal crime. But I think the distinction between a federal arrest and a state arrest is meaningful.
Still meaningful after the complaint, the federal complaint is issued?
Yes, I think so. I think so, yes.
What was the point of the federal complaint?
Well, the point of the federal complaint is to provide a basis for the detainer, I suppose, so that, you know, when he is released from state custody, the federal government is notified and he can be brought over, which is a good segue to the interstate agreement on detainers argument. The agreement itself states that it shall be liberally construed so as to effectuate its purposes. It doesn't say that it should be used as a sword by criminal defendants. I'm unable to identify a purpose behind the IAED which would be effectuated by the interpretation that Mr. Rosen is urging here, which is that the federal government's case is frozen in time at the juncture at which it charges a defendant by criminal complaint. That strikes me as a sort of an offensive use of, not distasteful, but an offensive as opposed to a defensive use of the interstate agreement on detainers, which exists to encourage the prompt resolution of cases and protect a prisoner's ability to participate in prison programming and that sort of thing.
And I thought there was also a purpose, if one had any argument to present to a governor, you know, in extradition matters, it gives it, the prison. There are some individual rights in the IAED. We've held not everything is an individual right, but like the order in which you serve your sentence is not an individual right, but there are other things that are.
Yes, I think that's true. The Fulcomer case refers to that ability of the defendant under, I think it's Article 3, to petition the governor of his state.
Right.
I suppose theoretically, Governor Walker in this case might have said, no, I'm not going to turn over Mr. Clark to the federal government. There's no evidence that Mr. Clark even wanted to do that, much less that he took any steps in that direction. The final argument wasn't really...
Is it at all significant that the... I'm not sure whether it was you or somebody in your office... used the writ of habeas corpus to get him over as opposed to something else?
Well, it is significant because in a real sense, the detainer had no effect in this case. The writ is what brought him into federal custody.
The writ brought him there, not the detainer.
And by that time, he had been indicted. It's not a situation where the receiving state took custody of him and then piled on a whole bunch of mysterious new charges. So I would say it is significant. Mm-hmm. I don't think my opponent addressed the search warrant issue. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have about that or any of the issues he raises in his brief.
I have a different question. I don't understand a 1,900-month sentence.
I'm sorry?
The 1,900-month sentence. I don't get that.
162 years. It was, I forget what the month, how many months that ended up being.
Does the bank robbery statute require consecutive sentences, or was this the judge's choice?
I think it was his choice with respect to the 2113 charges, the armed bank robbery. The 924C charges would have to be consecutive, and I think that's probably mostly what was driving the length of this sentence.
But why indict him for so many... bank robberies. I don't get it. What is the interest of the government in having a person like this sentenced to life?
He's an extremely dangerous individual.
No, but he's dangerous now. He's not going to be dangerous in 20 years, right? He's 45.
That sounds
20
about
years,
right.
He's not going to be dangerous. I don't understand it. I suppose, do you have a separate budget from the Bureau of Prisons?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Pardon?
I believe so, yes.
So you don't care how much of a burden you place on the Bureau of Prisons with these ridiculous sentences.
I don't think it's a ridiculous sentence.
So we can have all these old people dying at substantial government expense because it gives them good medical testimony. Very bad judgment. No other civilized country deals out sentences like this. And you don't have to, the judge may be bound, depending on, you know, obviously. But you don't have to indict for a zillion different bank robberies to get a substantial sentence.
Well, I respect your opinion.
I don't see any judgment.
I respect your opinion, Your Honor, but I'm not. First of all, I don't have to defend the sentence because it's not been appealed.
You can't really think that life sentences are appropriate in cases like this.
Participating in six armed robberies is
a very serious matter. So when he's 85, you want him to be in a prison getting, you know, Medicare. That's what you want.
That's what we argued for in this case, Your Honor. It's not been appealed. I'm not here to defend the sentence. But I would argue that Mr. Clark is a very dangerous individual. And in addition, since we've shifted into sentencing mode, there are other considerations besides incapacitation that the sentencing court would have to consider, such as deterrence. And I think those interests were served by a very lengthy sentence here. Mm-hmm. Any further questions from the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Rosen?
A couple of points I wanted to make. First of all, Mr. Koenig talked about Janik. I just looked at Janik while we had time. Janik is materially different from the case before you. In Janik, there was never any federal complaint. It was just state charges that kicked into federal indictment. There was never any federal complaint charged, which then turns 4 months later into a federal indictment. Now, it says, Janik says, there's abundant, and we think persuasive case authority that an arrest does not start the 30-day period running unless a criminal charge is lodged. And no federal criminal charge was lodged against Janik. There was no federal complaint. So clearly, Janik helps us. Second of all, I didn't want to talk about Mr. Koenig talked about the arrest. The arrest, Mr. Lipscomb told the court at trial, February 23rd, that it was a combined arrest. They stopped Mr. Clark because of the federal warrant. And Mr. Lipscomb told the court that this was an arrest both for the fleeing, because clearly, I think it's pretty clear that if he hadn't taken off, he would have been arrested in an armed bank robbery. But Mr. Lipscomb also told the court there was also the armed bank robbery that was also why he was arrested. And that's what I wanted to mention. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much. Thanks to both counsel. You were appointed, were you not, Mr. Rosen?
Yes, Your Honor.
We thank you very much for your assistance to your client and to the court. We'll take the case under advisement, and the court will be adjourned.